Hello and welcome to episode 263 of AvTalk. I am Ian Pechnik, here as always with...
Jason Rabinowitz. How's it going, Ian? How are you?
It's going well, Jason. It's going well. It's a week. Things have happened, and we've cobbled enough together to get another episode of the podcast. How are you, sir?
I'm good. I'm in DC for work this week, but I'm happy to be able to have this weekly therapy session with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's dive in, because I know you are in between meetings for your real job. So
yes, I am somewhere between lunch, a meeting, and a meeting, but this means a lot to me. So here I am, holed up in my hotel room with some Wi-Fi to try to knock this out before anyone notices I've snuck away.
We'll make it work. We begin with, let's start with the eclipse. Did you see it?
I was on an Amtrak Acela train headed south, which is the wrong direction, from New York to DC at the moment. So not most optimal way to see the eclipse for sure. I did see it by, you know, kind of sticking my phone at the window, cranking the exposure all the way to the bottom. And you could make out the moon. I think it was like an 85% eclipse, which was pretty cool. It got kind of dark, but it was also pretty cloudy. So it didn't really put on much of a show for me. But I'll check back in like, what is it, 2076 or something. I'll plan ahead a little better.
Well, I mean, we can make plans now for, I think, 2026. We can head to Iceland or Spain.
Russia. That sounds great. Better than being on a long past its expected lifespan Amtrak Acela train 45 minutes late heading to DC. So let's go to Iceland, please. That sounds
sure,
good.
Sure, let's do that. But there were lots of people who saw the eclipse from the air or from on the ground at an airport because they flew to an airport that was in the path of totality. So from about the middle of Texas all the way up through Maine, making an arc through southern Illinois, Arkansas, Ohio, and parts of New York, that was the path of totality. So what was interesting is that a bunch of airlines made special flights or said they were making special flights. A few of them took off way too early to actually see the eclipse.
Yeah, I think wasn't Air Canada one of them? Like they took off too early and then they got to Toronto before anything happened.
Yeah. And so all well and good there. And it sounds like people who booked these eclipse flights had, I don't want to call it a lackluster experience, but maybe not the experience that they were expecting.
Yeah. I think I read Zach Koenig of The Points Guy was on one of these Delta flights, I think on the A220. And he and some people he spoke to said, yeah, next time I'll just do this from the ground. Since the experience wasn't all that great for one thing, obviously, there is only one window seat per side of the aircraft in every row. So anyone who's in the middle seats or hopefully not an aisle seat, they're going to really strain their neck to have to see out that window or switch positions with people. But also in a lot of cases, the sun was kind of directly above the aircraft. And I don't know of any airplanes with moon roofs. So you're not going to get that great a view. But it seems like flight crews did their best to do some 360 turns and bank the aircraft to get the passengers to see as much as they possibly could. But it was more about the atmosphere, seemingly, that Delta and I haven't heard of any of the other U.S. airlines doing this, but Delta seems to have put on a really big show in the, I think it was DFW and maybe Houston for the departure of these flights. So it was definitely more about the atmosphere, but the actual viewing of the eclipse was pretty lackluster from all accounts, or at least that I have seen.
Yeah, but the flip side of that is all of the people who took private aircraft and either flew to an airport in the path of totality or just flew during the eclipse.
Kind of wherever they wanted to.
And looked out their window. Yeah. And so we put together a graphic because I was following along with this and thinking, you know, basically starting from the premise of Delta's doing these flights, Air Canada's doing these flights. That'll be interesting to look at. And then I noticed that there was so much general aviation traffic because the FAA had talked about, you know, how they were going to have delays and we're going to need to be rerouting and things like that. And so it sounded like the FAA was being a bit dramatic in that respect, but more power to them for preparing people for that. But then I looked and the amount of general aviation traffic was more than double the usual amount of traffic. I mean, it was just incredible. Thousands and thousands of aircraft.
I would definitely say the FAA did the right thing by over-preparing rather than under-preparing, because that's not really the moment you want to not take into account the doubling of general aviation traffic, which is going to be concentrated during a very specific time of day where conditions are getting really weird, getting rapidly dark and then rapidly bright. If there's any time you really want to probably overstaff and overcompensate it, it's a good pick.
Yeah. And so we put together a little graphic that we'll put a link in the show notes showing all the general aviation aircraft kind of converging on the path of totality, whether just flying or landing in an airport there, and then scattering again because it was such a quick event. But the eclipse wasn't even the weirdest thing to have happened and have an aviation angle this week. That, of course, at least I think the week, I guess, still isn't quite over yet, but there was an earthquake in New York.
Yeah. I mean, officially, I think the earthquake belongs to
New Jersey.
Yes, New Jersey.
We'll let them have it.
Like any good thing, we claim it our own. It was the New York earthquake. But yes, Friday last week, there was a 4.8 magnitude earthquake in White House Station, New Jersey, I think. And if you're from the West Coast or any earthquake-prone region, shut up. I know 4.8 is no big deal to you, but it's a big deal to us. Just look at LA when it rains. We laugh at you when it rains as well, so it's fine. But 4.8, it was definitely the largest earthquake in the New York City region in centuries, I think. Maybe not centuries, it's a little dramatic, but many, 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 many decades, I believe. Something like 125 years. But like all things, our good friend John Ostrower says, there's always an aviation angle. And of course, an earthquake in a region that is not prone to earthquakes and isn't really at all ready for it, there were impacts to the aviation system. JFK and LaGuardia really didn't have that much of an effect. They paused departures and arrivals for a very brief period. But like all other natural, man-made, metaphysical things, Newark didn't handle it so well.
Oh, Newark.
Yeah, Newark. They seemingly handled it pretty well for a while. The Port Authority did a pretty quick inspection of the runways, found no issues, and air traffic actually resumed quite quickly after the earthquake. And then, don't exactly know why, but they erred on the side of caution and evacuated the tower, which I guess is fine if there's any suspected damage or they need to do an inspection of something to the FAA air traffic control tower at Newark. Fine, do it. Better to be safe than sorry. So they evacuated the tower, and they have plans for this. They run drills and the preparedness opportunities, and they're supposed to be ready for this. But when they did transition over from the actual air traffic control center to the backup air traffic control center on the facility, which I think is in United's ground or ramp control tower, which is just another tower that typically handles the movements on United's own ramp, whatever radio setup the FAA was using there was horrible. At first, it didn't work at all. And then the signal was really, 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 really weak. So aircraft on approach had no radio reception until they were on like very short final. Aircraft on the ground on the far side of the field couldn't hear the tower at all. In my non-professional air traffic controller opinion, it was actually a quite dangerous situation. They probably should have halted all movements. It would have been better to be safe than sorry. Like, they evacuated the tower to be safe rather than sorry, but they seem to have been pushing aircraft movement when they probably shouldn't have been. You had the controller giving a landing clearance to an aircraft, and that aircraft couldn't hear them. So you had other aircraft on the ground having the pilots relay that clearance to the arriving or departing aircraft, which just strikes me as not a particularly good idea, especially at such a busy airport like Newark. But that went on for maybe about 30 minutes. They figured their situation out and got back in the tower, and Newark is back to being Newark.
Newark is back to being Newark. Yeah, it was interesting to me because they had one of the controllers in the tower. Well, he was saying, oh, they're going to set stuff up in the other location. I was like, well, obviously it seems fine if you're leaving a guy there. Why not just leave him there?
The whole transition was very odd. Clearly, there's some lessons to be learned from what happened at Newark. The backup facility they have there is not up to snuff. It is not sufficient to run that airport.
More hamster wheels.
Yeah, it should not happen again. So it's good that they got some lessons out of this, I hope. I'm assuming anyway, there have been some meetings held about the situation there. But yeah, the whole thing was just odd that I guess it is possible that the earthquake was more violent at Newark because it is in New Jersey, closer to the actual epicenter of the earthquake, which seemed quite violent there. But yeah, lesson learned about something very unexpected for New York, but we get it all.
So that was a bit of fun. Now on to the rest of the show. We, of course, turn now to the latest Boeing whistleblower allegations. This was first reported by the New York Times and subsequently reported more widely throughout the aviation and popular press. And it will also be part of a Senate hearing next week. Senator Richard Blumenthal is hosting a hearing called Examining Boeing's Broken Safety Culture, Firsthand Accounts. And so it'll be a collection of whistleblowers discussing their allegations. The most recent allegation, and I say this on the middle of Wednesday, April 10th, who knows what happens by the time the podcast comes out. But as of today, the most recent allegations are by Sam Selifor, who is a Boeing engineer and a Boeing quality engineer. And he has alleged that almost 1,000 787s and approximately 400 777s currently flying could be at risk for premature fatigue on the fuselage structure and, as he puts it, catastrophic failure. The FAA says that it is investigating his claims. Obviously, the prudent thing to do anytime you have an engineer coming forward. So good to see that they're taking this seriously. So what are the actual claims here? What he's saying is that when Boeing assembled the 787 fuselage, because they come from different manufacturers and are brought to, well, formerly Washington and South Carolina, now just South Carolina. But when they are brought to the assembly line, they are put together. And if there are gaps where the fuselage joins go, they require shimming. The shimming is what stopped all of Boeing's 787 deliveries for almost 2 years at one point, because of the necessity to get that shimming right and make sure that the fuselage sections were shimmed as needed, adding the necessary spacers. What he's claiming is that Boeing, in assembling the 787 fuselages, some of them, used enough force, an excessive amount of force, that it artificially shrunk the gaps between the fuselage sections, negating the use of shimming in those joints, because when they would measure it, it would say, okay, it's small enough, we don't need shims here. The problem is that those unfilled gaps can over time lead to excessive wear and stress on the fuselage joints, which is why he's saying that those aircraft are at risk for premature fatigue damage, because where fuselage joint shims should have been placed, they did not place them there because of the excessive amount of force that they pushed the fuselage sections together, made it artificially small, and they didn't put shims in. Boeing says that this is not a safety of flight risk. Any problems that could possibly arise from this are outside the life of the airplane. They're pointing to the tests that they performed on one of the early build 787s, where they placed it through 165,000 pressurization cycles, which is nearly four times the number of pressurization cycles that a 787 will expect to go through in its lifetime. So a normal 787 will be pressurized and depressurized 44,000 times. So Boeing says this isn't a safety of flight problem. We've tested these well beyond where any airline is going to be flying them as far as the fuselage pressurization cycles goes. And so we don't think that this is an accurate way to look at things. That's Boeing's take on the 787 there.
And there's an interesting series of quotes here from the New York Times where they're quoting Boeing, and things kind of change from quote to quote. The first one they say, "Our engineers are completing complex analysis to determine if there may be a long-term fatigue concern for the fleet in any area of the airplane," Mr. Lewis said, Mr. Lewis being one of the spokespeople for Boeing. Then goes on to say, "This would not become an issue for the in-service fleet for many years to come, if ever, and we are not rushing the team so that we can ensure that analysis is comprehensive." But in the very next statement, they say, in a subsequent statement, Boeing said that it was, quote, "fully confident in the 787 Dreamliner," adding that "these claims about the structural integrity of the 787 are inaccurate and do not represent the comprehensive work Boeing has done to ensure the quality and long-term safety of the aircraft." So which is it? Is there an acknowledged problem that they're analyzing now to figure out if this will become a problem in the future? Or does this issue not exist? And good job, everyone. We believe we built safe long-term aircraft. Maybe I'm misreading it, but I feel like those two statements are actually opposing each other pretty severely.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure what they're trying to say, honestly. And I think part of the problem is that you have multiple statements and it's unclear exactly what questions those statements are responding to. Because there are multiple, and this part doesn't really reflect well on Boeing, there are multiple issues over the past few years with the 787 program. And there are multiple claims of problems with the 787's assembly. So it's one of those things where you need to be more specific, I think, about which problems you're talking about.
Oof. So when you call Boeing Corpcoms, do you get a phone tree that says, if you're calling about the battery thermal runaway, press 1. If you're calling about the shims, press 2.
Please listen carefully as our menu options have changed.
Oh, ouch. Yeah, maybe this could help Boeing. I don't know.
So that's the 787. Sellafor is also talking about the 777.
Oh, no, but the 777 is supposed to be like Boeing's rock. It's all they've got left that works.
So this is a really interesting thing because we often look at the 777 as the last Boeing-built airplane, which celebrated its 30th anniversary of rollout yesterday on the 9th of April. So on April 9th, 1994, the 777 rolled out for the first time. And everyone lost their minds, and rightfully so, because it's an awesome airplane. But in 2014, as part of Boeing's push to cut costs and allow suppliers to control more of how it built its aircraft, Boeing created what they called the fuselage upright build system.
I had completely forgotten about this.
And it worked so well that it was implemented in 2015 and abandoned mostly by 2019.
Maybe that's why I forgot about it.
And what Sellafor's claims are related to the 777 program are that the system didn't work. And so assembling the aircraft fell back to a lot of manual work. The fuselage upright build system included a lot of robotics and automatic machining and things like that, and it just didn't work for Boeing for a variety of reasons. And so it fell back to a lot of manual work, and so you were ending up with misaligned fuselage sections on the 777. And so I think the biggest eye-opening claim here is that he witnessed Boeing assembly workers jumping on panels to get them to align.
Huh. Probably not in any procedure or guideline they have on assembly.
To the best of my knowledge, that is not how you're supposed to assemble aircraft.
Can't say I ever saw that doing a tour of the Everett facility. So that would have been surprising. I would have questioned that myself.
Pointed that one out, raised a hand. So the FAA is investigating this and investing in the claims. I don't think they've said they've opened an investigation of Boeing. They're investigating the claims, and they will be part of a Senate hearing next week. All of this to say is that, I mean, it's one after the other, and whoever becomes the next CEO of Boeing is going to have a lot on their plate and a very, very long road ahead rebuilding trust in the organization.
I don't know who would want this job, but good luck.
Yeah. I mean, we'll certainly talk about that when the time comes. But let's move on from this, and we'll revisit it next week after the Senate hearing. So let's head down to Houston, shall we? And talk about the NTSB's preliminary report on the United 737 that suffered a runway and taxiway excursion about a month ago. That was the one where the United 737 made a right turn off the runway and then skidded into the grass and ended with the nose high in the air and the tail well down on the ground. And the preliminary report explains exactly why the aircraft ended up like that. And I learned a few new things.
What did you learn?
Well, I learned that the main landing gear on the 737 is designed to shear off in certain circumstances when stressed in certain ways. It makes perfect sense. And we've talked about shear pins and different parts of aircraft that are supposed to come off when stressed in a variety of ways. But the main landing gear on the 737 is designed to shear off in specific circumstances, especially when an extreme lateral load is placed on the landing gear. And in this case, that was because the 737 drove into a concrete bunker.
Huh. Okay. Not supposed to happen, but that certainly explains why the gear sheared off. We had a lot of debate about whether or not the gear collapsed or broke away in the immediate aftermath, because the pictures were very unclear. It looked fine, but I don't think anyone knew, although anyone who would have been standing there at the aircraft would have saw that, oh, there's a concrete bunker here. I think it was for the runway electrical system for the lighting.
It was a utilities access vault.
Yes, because no aircraft is supposed to be there, so it shouldn't be a problem. But props to Boeing on this one, I guess, for designing an airplane that can be driven into a bunker and it barely looks broken.
It was fine enough that they raised the airplane up, reattached the landing gear, and towed it away. Yeah. So good for them. The reason for the excessive speed from the interview with the captain sounds like the aircraft, and this was part of the air traffic control audio kind of initially after the incident where we knew about this, where they had been asked to keep up their speed. The captain said, well, we wanted to keep up our speed to get off at the end of the runway, and the aircraft didn't brake the way the captain was expecting it to. And the runway conditions seem to have been poorer than the captain believed. That will all, of course, become part of the final report. But the interview with the captain is an interesting one that's included there in the
preliminary. Seems like just a set of bad circumstances. And I did want to point out that I saw some questioning of the air traffic controller giving that command of keep your speed up. And that is not at all an unusual or unwarranted thing. In this case, I believe the captain or whoever was on the radio of the United flight asked to take a specific taxiway turn off the runway. And in that case, air traffic control said, yes, so long as you keep your speed up, which basically means please do not come to a crawl on the runway. Do not stop on the runway because there are other arrivals behind you. So you can do it at your discretion. Just please don't slow down to the point where it impacts the aircraft behind you. So not unusual, not strange in any way, but taken out of context from people who may not really know the ins and outs of what's going on there, it could sound a little odd. Like, oh, well, air traffic control told them to keep their speed up, so that's why it happened. Well, no, that's not how that works.
That's a good point. Part of that incident played into the FAA's review of United's operations, and it seems that we're seeing the first impact of these, where United's had to delay route expansions because of the ongoing increased oversight.
Yeah, this is nonsensical, I would say. At least that's my personal opinion. United's no longer able to launch this coming summer Newark Faro and Tokyo to Cebu, which would have been a revival of one of its Tokyo hub or formerly hub routes on the 737. The former will launch the following year, and Tokyo Cebu will launch, I believe, in October of this year, something along those lines. So any passenger who had already possibly booked those routes, they are now out of luck. They'll need to figure something else out. I don't like this. I don't think it accomplishes anything. I think there was still, and we talked about this, I think there was undue focus on United, one of the world's largest airlines, if not the largest by some metrics. Stuff happens. The media kind of caught in on this and sunk their teeth into it and really made it seem like there was more going on at United than there was. And yeah, there were some incidents. But to take the step of removing the authority for United to launch new routes is, I'm not going to call it unprecedented, but for as a reaction to something like this, it is certainly not with any precedent I cannot come up with.
It's certainly
right now.
Disproportionate.
Yeah, it does seem out of proportion. And Brett Snyder, Cranky Flyer, has a good breakdown of what's going on in his blog and could chalk it up to, well, maybe United's not playing ball with the FAA. Maybe they're being stubborn or not cooperative in some investigation, and this is their way of saying cooperate or else. I don't know, but I just don't see how this is possibly helpful or beneficial if there is a safety culture issue or a maintenance culture issue at United, I don't see how this helps to rectify that situation at all.
Hopefully they get things squared away between United and the FAA rather quickly, because it seems like this, if this goes on, it could really negatively impact a lot of customers for the airline. Yes. And then you end up with people mad at the airline when the FAA is saying, no, you can't do certain things.
There are probably some people down in Mexico saying, ah, now you know how it feels. I hope this does not go on as long as the FAA's lowering of the safety rating for Mexico went on, because that went on for years longer than anyone expected. I cannot imagine that would be the case here with United, but we'll see.
I remember we first talked about the downgrade of Mexico's status by the FAA, and we were like, ah, 6 weeks.
Yeah, no big deal.
It was a big deal. It was a big deal. Where are we going next? Well, we're not going anywhere.
Wow. I mean, if you've got a fleet powered by the Pratt & Whitney GTF engine, there is a 33% chance you're not going anywhere, is there?
So Cirium came out with a look at the number of Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan engine powered aircraft that are currently grounded, and it measures about a third. I crunched the numbers based on our own data at Flight Radar 24, and it's roughly equal. I mean, obviously, there's both databases don't say exactly why an aircraft hasn't flown. So Cirium tags their flights as, you know, parked technical reason. So it could be the engine, it could be, you know, something else. And obviously, there's probably a slight mix, but the number of aircraft that have not flown in some time that are powered by Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan engines is creeping up. As of today, Wizz Air has 73 geared turbofan powered aircraft parked that haven't flown in April. I'm using in April as a benchmark here. Indigo has 64. Go First has all of theirs because they don't exist anymore. Ooh. But here's where it gets interesting. Air China, 28. Volaris, 26. Viva Aerobus, 23. Sichuan, 21. ANA, 20. So some names that we haven't really discussed before. We haven't talked about ANA so much in this context. Air China, we really haven't talked about in this context. And again, this is not to say that necessarily all of these are grounded specifically for engine issues. They could be down for other maintenance. They could be just not needed in the fleet at the moment. But there are multiple airlines not operating large chunks of their A320neo family fleets or A220 fleets or a very small collection of E2 jets. But it's a lot of planes.
It's a lot. And I was going to say, we almost always talk about this in the context of the 320 and 220 family aircraft. And then every now and then someone says, yeah, what about the E2s? I'm like, yeah, what about them? But finally, Cirium put the numbers together and there are 101 E2s in service. 17 of them are out of service. So that is a large percentage of that fleet. But I don't want to call it a rounding error, but it kind of is in the grand scheme of things because there just aren't that many E2s out there. But we would be remiss to not mention that, yeah, Embraer is also impacted by this.
And I don't know about you, Jason, but I'm just learning about Plaza Linhas Arias. Azul? I've never heard of them before, but they're a Brazilian airline and they have an E190 E2.
That's Azul.
And it's grounded. So
that's Azul. That's the business name for Azul, I believe.
I learn something new every day.
Today you learned. I don't know what article would put that full name.
This is why I keep you around.
That would be Azul.
That's the registered owner of the aircraft.
Yes. And I think there's a pretty good quote here from a Fly Global article citing the Cirium data. This quote comes from Swiss's chief executive. And the quote is, "The problem of our aircraft being unproductive is the fact that we are paying twice. We have aircraft investments unproductive on the ground, and we have to rent wet lease aircraft from another company to produce the capacity in the market." So yeah, not only are they paying for the aircraft and the engines that they can't use, but then they have to pay again to have somebody else on another airline come in and operate flights for them, which in turn turns out to be Air Baltic and Helvetic Airways, though both also use GTF-powered aircraft. So it's really just a nice circle. The circle of the GTF life here is just strange.
Ew. One airline that is dealing with GTF issues and A320 family issues is Spirit Airlines. And as part of that now, they are deferring aircraft deliveries and furloughing some pilots, both as a reaction to some of the engine issues, but also just general business malaise.
Yeah. Furloughing pilots, not great. That's a move of last resort. You wouldn't have thought something like that would happen given the last couple of years of not being able to hire pilots fast enough, being a severe pilot drought. Now this airline has an excess of pilots due to situations that it just can't control. And not only is it furloughing pilots, but they're also deferring precious, precious Airbus narrowbody delivery slots that I'm sure there are other airline CEOs out there frothing at the mouth at the thought of 17 delivery slots opening up in the next 2 years for aircraft that are sold out through the end of the decade. So someone at Airbus might be doing a little dance of happiness, so, although it is at the expense of Spirit, unfortunately.
It's such a turn because Spirit's retiring A319 fleet. They're deferring deliveries of new Airbus aircraft now because of business issues. And so now they have to contend with those two things, the grounding of the aircraft, and then they end up with more pilots than they need, which is not true. You know, it's one of those things where it's the realities have made it true, but it's not actually true, it shouldn't be true,
The situation shouldn't exist. It's not that they hire too many pilots. It's that they don't have enough aircraft for those pilots, which is a problem.
Hopefully, the furloughs are not going to start until the beginning of September. Hopefully, Spirit can turn things around, and hopefully the pilots that are impacted are not impacted very long. We've got some stuff on the back end of the show to just kind of get through news and notes. SAS has finally committed to joining SkyTeam at the end of August, and I feel a certain kind of way about that, but we'll see how things go.
Yeah, it's fine. I'd prefer them stay in Star Alliance, but SkyTeam, sure, whatever. At least maybe the integration will be a little bit better than it is with SAS with Star Alliance, and they weren't even really a part of the transatlantic JV, or there were no code shares. So maybe this one will be a little more useful.
Yes, this should be a bit more useful. We've got some delivery roundup for both Q1 and March of 2024. Just double checking what year it is. Jason, why don't you give me the Boeing numbers to start?
Well, the Boeing numbers, you have to squint because they're kind of small, but they managed to deliver 67 737s, 3 767s. I believe those aren't even commercial aircraft. Those might be military, maybe the tankers. I'm not sure. Nobody's taking 767s anymore. But they managed to also deliver 13 787s for a total of 83 aircraft, which of course is well below the target. But 83 is better than some other quarters we've seen where the number's damn near zero.
Yeah, I mean, not nothing. It is quite down from last quarter. But Q4 is usually a big quarter no matter what, because if everyone wanting their aircraft by the end of the year.
Push, push, push.
Airbus, on the other hand, delivered 142 aircraft. So a big jump for them from last quarter, which is interesting.
Yeah.
To my mind.
We know of one aircraft that has now practically been undelivered, I think. I think it's safe to say this one ain't coming back anytime soon. And it wasn't even a year old, the poor thing. What happened?
No, that's a great question. So based on what we know so far, it sounds like this particular aircraft was being towed from a remote stand to a gate, and the Austrian Airlines A320neo was not chocked, and it was not braked, and it decided that it was going to go back into a pole. And that ripped off the right horizontal stabilizer. Not damaged it, Not bent it. Off. Ripped it right off the airplane.
Never seen damage like this. It is not super uncommon to see the wingtip or the horizontal stabilizer of an aircraft be dented by hitting a pole or another aircraft or the jet bridge or any one of the thing many, many things to hit.
Like happened earlier this week at Heathrow.
Yeah. Let's not talk about that one. Okay. But this one cleanly sheared off the stabilizer, which is absurd. That is not supposed to happen.
Yeah.
I am going to be – I don't want to say I'll be surprised if this aircraft re-enters service because we have seen aircraft far more gone than this one. And there also was damage to the wing because not just the horizontal stabilizer – being knocked off, but for completeness sake, the right-hand wing also was backed into a light pole, because of course it was. But we have seen charbroiled aircraft brought back from the brink of death. I think that aircraft is still flying today.
Yeah.
But not great when this aircraft is less than a year old. Might even still be under warranty. I don't know. But we're going to keep an eye on this one. This would be OELZQ, Airbus A321neo for Austrian. That it looks like Austrian is not just going to have to worry about GTF problems, but they're going to have to worry about backfilling this aircraft this summer.
I mean, at least this summer, if not
several summers.
If not several summers. I mean, I have to believe it'll fly again.
I hope so.
The Airbus OAG team's going, yes, we can fix it.
There's probably also someone from the AOG team staring under this thing, scratching their head going, what? How? Like, where do we begin?
How did you manage to screw this up so badly?
How do we begin with this?
That's a paddling. In much more fixable news, a Southwest 737 on departure out of Denver went engine cowling go Flappy Bird, and the engine cowling was ripped off in the slipstream. This is not new. This is not unusual. Well, I should say it's unusual, but it's not unheard of.
Yes, but there's video. So
But there's video, exactly. So Southwest 737, the engine cowling, so the housing that goes around the actual engine, the painted pieces that go around the actual engine that are open for maintenance access and things of that nature, those were likely not properly latched before takeoff, and they unlatched entirely on the takeoff roll, and then by the time the aircraft circled back to the airport, both cowling sides had departed the aircraft.
Yeah, definitely interesting that it was both in this circumstance. It wasn't just one side of the aircraft, which I think is more what we typically see. This was both sides of the, not aircraft, of the engine itself, the right-hand engine. Maybe the right-hand side caused damage to the left side, but also both of them not being properly latched. I feel like maybe a walk around should have potentially caught that. I feel like that's probably something to take a look at, but I have also heard, I probably shouldn't even say this, but I have been told that unconfirmed that
Southwest pilots. Now you have to say it.
Yeah, now I have to say it, that Southwest pilots typically conduct a walk around of the aircraft at the start of their day with that aircraft, because Southwest is commonly known for operating multiple segments with the same crew along the day of the aircraft, and that they don't actually do a walk around after every flight along that path. I really don't know if there's any truth to that, but it could explain why possibly this wasn't seen in this case. Maybe they did a little engine top off mid route.
Podcast at fr24.com. Yes, let us know.
Confirm or deny. I
guarantee somebody knows out there.
Yes.
And then we close the show by bidding farewell to Jason.
Get back to the Southwest thing. So quickly. I've been fired.
Jason is leaving the podcast and the United States to go be the next chief executive of South African Airways. Congratulations, Jason.
Nope. Don't want that. I mean, it's a better position than CEO of Boeing, for sure. But South African Airways is not now, nor has been in a very long time, a stable airline. That is a tough question.
It's even less stable now.
I think they did just recently reintroduce long-haul flights using A320 4300s that they found in the garbage somewhere. I don't know, but that's a start.
Well, if you don't want to be the chief executive officer of South African Airways, you can apply to be the chief commercial officer, the South African Airways technical arm. You can be the chief human capital officer, or, and here's the best job you can apply for, the chief of air chefs.
Ooh, that sounds nice.
So if anybody out there wants to apply for one of these positions, email us at podcast@fr24.com and tell us why you would want to do this.
What's your plan for turning around South African Airways? Because they could use one.
But good luck. This has been episode 263 of AvTalk. I want to thank everyone who made it to the end of the show for listening. Very much appreciated. And we would just like to lean on you slightly more and ask for a rating or a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the podcast if you're enjoying it. And it helps other people, like Jason and I, improve the podcast if you have some comments or criticism. So by all means, let us know that. We've just given you the email address, but we'll do it again. If you have questions, comments, podcast@fr24.com. We're always happy to learn from our listeners. Often our best content comes from suggestions from you fine people, so keep them coming. I am Ian Pechnik, here as always with
Jason Rabinowitz. Thanks for listening.